Shirley Abrahamson.
Justice, you are live in the hearing room.
Thank you, Tina.
You're welcome. All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, we have a full house today. It's very nice to see you all in here on this sunshiny day. And very interesting petition to take up and to hear testimony on. Before I begin, I want to let you know that though Justice Abrahamson's chair is absent, she is participating by phone. So if you hear words from the clouds, it's Justice Abrahamson wanting to ask a speaker a question. I want you also to know that I'm going to be a real stickler about time today. We have had the opportunity to read letters from many, many interested people, and we appreciate the letters. But if you've signed up to speak and you want to tell us what's in your letter, please don't. We have a lot of people that we need to hear from today, and if we're going to repeat ourselves, we're never going to get through all that I have on our agenda to get through. So I will remind you that you are going to have a limited time. I think our presenters have 30 minutes between them, and they've worked out with the marshal how they intend to use that time. And we have 20 minutes for Norman Reimer. I don't believe I know him. All right, very good. You were to have 30 minutes, but your colleague had a problem with the airplane. Okay, so everyone else is going to be limited to 5 minutes. It doesn't seem like a lot. But for some of the speakers, they've written very informative and wonderful letters. We have read them all. So we don't need to have things repeated. I think the petition is a serious matter, and we are interested in getting on with it. So I'll now call the presenters to begin with the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 8102 and Petition 1706.
May it please the court, my name is Henry Schultz.
Excuse me just a minute. I can't hear you. You're going to have to put your mic up a little bit.
Okay.
And also, you're tall enough. I don't know if he needs to raise the podium, Tina.
And Chief Justice, how much time does he have?
He has, he and his colleague have 30 minutes 30 together, and
together.
They've
okay.
decided how they will
Great.
Share it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Much better.
My name is Henry Schultz. Most people call me Hank. I am one of the co-counsels for this petition, along with Attorney John Birdsall. We represent the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Wisconsin Association for Justice, and about 40 other named petitioners on the cover of our petition. We are here today seeking a raise in the appointed counsel rate, whether it be through this court, through the circuit courts, or through the public defender system under Chapter 977 to $100 per hour. That is our goal.
Counsel, I'm sorry. This is Shirley Abrahamson. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but unless you speak directly into the microphone and maybe a little slower than you usually speak, you are not coming through on the telephone, and I would like to hear you.
I understood her to ask me to speak slower.
Yeah, a little bit
and
slower,
speak up.
And maybe a little
she
bit,
can't hear you.
A little bit
All right.
louder.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I'll go back a bit. We are here seeking a raise in the appointed counsel rate to $100 an hour, whether or not that is through a circuit court appointment, an appointment from this court, or through Chapter 977, which is the public defender statute.
Let me start at the outset, then. I thought the petition was only vis-a-vis our Supreme Court rule and not Chapter 977.
It is our goal to achieve that 977 result. We are asking
Here
this
today?
Court, we are not, no, we are not expecting that this court's action will directly cause the appropriation of funds to fund that change, but we are hoping that it is a step in the right direction, a first step that is necessary in this area of shared authority with the legislature to achieve that result, and that's why we're here. Our goal is $100 an hour for all appointments. We believe it's a modest goal. We believe it is one that is long overdue. The $70 an hour rate is a rate that was established by this court in 1994. It had been $50 an hour in the 80s prior to that, at least that was for in-court time. And even at that rate, we are seeing problems getting attorneys assigned and problems, frankly, with the quality of representation. I know you've indicated that the court has reviewed all the letters. I'm not going to go through them in detail for that reason, but $70 an hour is a problem. $40 an hour is a much bigger problem. This court acknowledged back in 2011, in response to the last petition of this sort, that the court saw an impending constitutional crisis, and this court had shared authority. We believe that this is the...
Counsel, perhaps we could focus on that shared authority piece.
Sure.
And I'm not sure you're going to find much disagreement on the bench about whether $40 is an adequate rate. I noticed that one of the authors of the letters indicated that clipping a poodle will get you more than $40 an hour.
You have to know Steve Zaleski to appreciate that.
So I think I'm with you. I think $40 is abysmal. I'm not sure $100 is enough. But the question is whether the court has the authority to tell a county or the state how much money to appropriate to pay for counsel. So tell me about that.
I'd be happy to do that. However, I would note in the interest of efficiency that Co-counsel Mr. Birdsall is planning on addressing that in more detail. I would be happy to answer if you'd like.
Well, we can wait for Mr. Birdsall.
Okay, be happy to do. Thank you very much. In this state, 40% of the cases that are assigned to the public defender program are assigned to private attorneys. The problem that we have all over the state at this time is that we are seeing a collapse of the criminal system as a whole because of that rate. We have incarcerated defendants who are appearing without a lawyer. We have counties where it takes weeks and it takes months to find a lawyer. We have judges telling us and telling you that there are adjournments too numerous to count and that there are intolerable delays. And that we have substantial inefficiencies on a daily basis.
Counsel,
what inefficiencies aren't just in the northern counties or in the rural counties, but they're being exacerbated by the lack of lawyers in those areas and having to bring lawyers from the downstate areas out to the more rural areas, and consequently, we have this problem being paramount all over the place.
Counsel, what is the authority to hold indigent defendants for extended periods of time because counsel has not been able to be procured for them?
There isn't any that I know of. And I think what's happening around the state is that judges are taking a variety of approaches. Some are not appointing a lawyer. Some are at county expense. That's one of the problems that we have. We have county boards that aren't budgeted for this. I don't think that there is any authority. And when you have a denial of counsel, and that is a denial of counsel, you have a constitutional crisis.
So why isn't this addressed from that perspective, rather than the what appears to me to be an indirect attempt to assert our authority in a matter of finance? And we'll talk to Mr. Birdsall about that more. Why not go at this directly as a deprivation of counsel under the Sixth Amendment?
That is an option. We are hoping that this court will show the leadership and use its shared authority to take what action it can take.
Well, we'll talk about the shared authority later, because I have grave reservations about that.
What about
the direct approach? What about saying, look, this person is held right now for an unreasonable period of time. He's been denied counsel. Constitutional violation, address it that way.
I agree that that could be one way to approach it.
Is anyone doing that?
Not that I know of.
Well, Massachusetts did. They took
right.
a pretty aggressive approach and issued orders to show cause why
yes.
pretrial detainees should not be released after 7 days if no counsel was appointed. I'll echo Justice Kelly. I don't know that there's any disagreement on the bench that $40 is, I think the word used was abysmal. There's other words for it. But the issue I have, and I think other justices have, is we don't have the power of the purse. So we're looking at, and I think if the presenters could focus, at least for me, on what our authority is, what our power is, because we understand the crisis, and it does seem to have risen, at least arguably, to the level of a constitutional crisis, but it's not presented to us quite that way.
We are asking you to take what we believe is relatively minimal action in response to your question, Justice Kelly, Justice Bradley, that we think could push us in the right direction. For example, if this court raises the court appointment rate to $100 per hour, and as the counties have noted in their submission, that will result in more appointments going out at that rate. The counties will then be in a position to ask the legislature for this funding for Chapter 977 cases.
Right. But counsel, I mean, let's go back to the assumption of that premise, and that is that the court exercising the power of the purse is a relatively minor thing. It's not. That's a major thing for us to assert the authority, the power of the purse. I mean, way back when we started this whole experiment, a couple hundred years ago, when we were describing the differences in the branches, the judiciary was described as not having the power of the purse or of the sword.
In this state, we have a somewhat unusual lack of checks and balances under our state constitution. It is shared authority in most respects. Now, I will agree with you, Justice Kelly, that we do not have a direct pipeline to the state budget for this court to tap into. I wholeheartedly agree. But we are asking the court to exercise the leadership, and because this court is in a position to better know.
Counsel, this is not a question of leadership. It's a question of power, right? Do we have the power to tell counties how much to spend on attorneys? Do we have the power to tell legislators how much to spend on attorneys?
This court has already told the legislature how much to spend on appointed counsel when it comes from a circuit court, when it comes to a GAL, when it comes to what we call a dean appointment for someone who is not eligible for public defender but is still indigent. This court has already done that. We are seeking an increase in that rate. 8102 covers indigent appointments. It also covers appointments for judges and a variety of other things. We are seeking an increase in that rate and a finding that anything below that is unreasonable.
If we do that, the counties are going to bear the burden immediately, right?
Yes.
And then you think that will put some pressure on the legislature to provide the funding? Is that the
They have
idea?
A counties association. They have an organization that lobbies the legislature. They are in a position to do that. That is, I believe that will be a consequence, yes.
But that's a $62 million increase, according to the State Public Defender's Office.
Biennially, for every 2 years. It's about $32 million a year.
I don't want to interfere. Are you done? Okay. I don't want to interfere with what Attorney Birdsall may be approaching with the court, but I want to make sure that we're comparing apples to apples and that the court is on the same page with you. Initially, you made sort of a sweeping statement about wanting court-appointed, this court's appointments, and public defender appointments to have the same rate, and I think that's a good goal. What you're hearing the court struggle with a bit is some of those appointments are driven by amounts set by the court, and some of those appointments are driven by statute. And, you know, I've done a lot of these appointments over the years and worked with the county board to set reasonable rates on a fee for lawyers. You have one issue when it comes to the public defender rate, $40, which is set by statute, which when people qualify, albeit as unusually rare as that is, in fact, more people should be able to qualify so the burden doesn't lay on the counties. That's a whole different issue for a different day.
I was going to talk about that, but I see my time.
It might be an issue for today, but it's an issue that's significant. But there is an interlay between these things, and there is what we can do and what we might be able to provide guidance on but not directly do. So when it comes to people who qualify, that rare group of people that qualify for public defender representation. The public defender then has to find lawyers because, for example, in Washington County, I think we had 1.5 public defenders when I was a judge there. That's not enough for all the people that qualify. So they have to find people to take those appointments, and they have to find people under the statute to take them at $40 an hour. That becomes tricky for the public defender. That's statutorily driven. Then you have things like court-appointed lawyers, where I've decided maybe you don't qualify for public defender assistance, but I'm going to appoint you a lawyer, dean, or otherwise just appoint a lawyer. You could set a payment plan. You can do a variety of things with respect to a court-appointed lawyer. And some people, there are no payment plans. That's a whole different category of things that happens. Then the individual counties and the courts have the authority to set a rate by which that lawyer will be paid, and sometimes our court can provide guidance on what is a reasonable rate in that regard. For me, at the time, it was 40 because it was just following the statutes, but our lawyers weren't really taking those. And so I had to work with the county board, work with the public defender, work with a variety of people to find a reasonable rate at which counsel would take those cases. We raised it to 65 at the time, which was deemed to be reasonable for that. At the same time, guardian ad litem appointments were receiving $70 an hour. For whatever reason, there was a disparity between them. And that was driven, as I understood it, as a circuit court judge, by the Supreme Court rule and how that would go down. So, and then you have appointments by this court as well. So there are different categories of these, and our hands might be a little bit tied in certain categories, but there has been court set rates in the past for how what we deem as a reasonable rate. So you might want to be a little specific on what you're talking about, even though I know your broader goal is, please, all of these are unreasonable. They all need to be raised, show some leadership. But you're hearing some questions that, there are things that we have more ability to address, maybe. Maybe not.
Yes. This court has taken action on attorney fee issues in the past, in the Friedrich case, in the Haysbrook, Door County case. The court has approved rates in excess of what was either set by Supreme Court rule or by statute for the payment of counsel when it found that those lower rates were not enough. And we're asking the court to do something similar here, although admittedly a Supreme Court rule doesn't directly change not Chapter 977. In the Haysbrook case, in a concurring opinion, Justice Abrahamson talked about the 8102 as a guideline for reasonable fees. And indeed, that's what we are trying to accomplish here from this court, in the vein that you were just speaking of, Justice Ziegler. We believe it is within the court's province to do that, and it is something that the court needs to do, or we're going to continue to see the sort of collapse that is going on everywhere all the time.
I'd like to give you an analogous situation, but I don't want to take up your time.
My red light is on.
His red light is on.
So then I'll bother Attorney Birdsell and ask him.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
My name is John Birdsell. I represent the petitioners. I already know what you want to know.
Before you get there on what we want to know, the court, another thing, I'm just going to my experience because that's what I can draw upon here. When we built a courthouse, it was helpful to me to go to the Supreme Court guidelines and say to the county board, look, these are the guidelines that the Supreme Court has said are reasonable guidelines when it comes to building a building. Of course the Supreme Court can't dictate what Washington County's courthouse must have and the amounts of money that they must pay in building that courthouse, but they certainly were helpful guidelines for us to use when talking about what's deemed reasonable in the industry and reasonable when it comes to building courthouses. Do you view that as an analogous situation to what you're asking for today, or is that completely different than what you're asking for?
No, it's not completely different. In fact, directly related to what you just talked about, In Re Courtroom, 1912, this court approved an order by the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, which held the county board in contempt for failure. They built a courtroom for Branch 5 in Milwaukee County without a jury room. And the circuit court said, I'm sorry, but this is not going to work for me, and so I'm holding you in contempt. And this court said, that's a proper exercise of judicial power to tell a legislative body what to do when it comes to the efficient and proper administration of the courts. And so, but in a broader sense, what you're talking about is there's got to be some accommodation. There's got to be some working with the legislative bodies that appropriate money. Is that what basically you're asking?
Yes and no. I mean, the court set forth guidelines, even though the court has no ability to require counties to pay that money to build courtrooms, yet we felt the court felt it was within its province to do so.
So in the In Re courtroom case, it was instructive. The court made very clear that they can't just say, build me the Taj Mahal. But you can say, I have to have something with which I can function as a court. And if I can analogize that to counsel, it's the entire state's duty to fulfill the Gideon mandate. It's not assigned to one legislative branch, it's not assigned to one branch of government. It is Wisconsin's government's duty. And for 40 years, we have failed. 40 years, we, Wisconsin, as a whole, have failed to fund half of our justice system, half of our public defense system.
So let's say that's true, and I think it is necessarily true that each branch has a role to play in ensuring that the Sixth Amendment guarantee is carried out. But that gets expressed through three branches of government. And simply because one fails does not mean the other can pick up the mantle. So tell me about how this court would have authority to tell the legislature or the county how much it must spend.
Absolutely. So, as I said, this is a state obligation. When
yes, but you're talking to the judiciary.
I understand.
All right.
I'm getting there. This court is responsible, I'm sure we agree on this, for the administration of justice in this state. Part of that justice system is our public defense system through the Gideon Mandate. You asked earlier about, well, why don't you have a Sixth Amendment analysis to this? Why don't you have a Sixth Amendment, you know, Strickland chronic sort of lawsuit? Is that basically what you were asking before?
Sort of. Here's, let me just lay the cards out on the table. I know how you can get all the money that you need to fund public defenders. And that is to bring cases that say you cannot hold this indigent defendant because you've not provided counsel, so cut him loose. And if that starts happening on a regular basis, the legislature will go into special session and they will raise this rate so fast it'll make your head swim.
Well, that could certainly happen, and that would be a tragic way to go.
Yep.
Because not only have we seen basically a meltdown in many counties around the state, and I'm talking about the rural ones up northern Wisconsin, Ashland, Bayfield, we're talking about Eau Claire, we're talking about Marathon, we're talking about all over the state, even in Milwaukee. So solutions like that might happen. But you know what? They've already seen, the legislature and the governor have already seen, and I'm not just talking about the present ones, I'm talking about for decades now, they've seen the gradual meltdown going on here. So that would be a bit of a pipe dream to hope, and in our wildest dreams, that they might pick up on that.
Well,
if
the legislature were to see that defendants were not being prosecuted because there were insufficient number of counsel available for them, I think they'd fix that because the legislature wants to see the law enforced.
Well, Justice Kelly, the legislature already sees everything that we see.
What they see is poor compensation, but they still see that attorneys are being provided, and they figure, well, that's okay.
This is what they see. They see months in jail for people. That's just the defendants. And then the DAs who wrote to this court, they said, we have to do the defense attorney's job so we don't have an ineffective assistance of counsel case. And then there's the victims. They have to come to court time and time and time again. And then there's the sheriffs who have to jail these people and transport them to court and have that county expense. I don't know. I'm not an economist, so I can't do the numbers on what all that costs, but it's got to be astronomical. And to do a Sixth Amendment sort of analysis, to come at this from some sort of a place where we're going to raise this on a constitutional level, well, you're talking about a class action lawsuit. That's not something we want to bring to Wisconsin. That's not something this court wants to come to Wisconsin.
Counsel, earlier reference was made to the Massachusetts Supreme Court that had a case apparently similar. I haven't looked at the case. I just read the summary. But their order was that any indigent defendant who didn't have counsel after 6 days would be released in order to show cause, and 45 days the case would be dismissed. That was how the Massachusetts Supreme Court case dealt with that when a court case is brought. What about, has any case similar been brought in federal court where the federal government has taken over the system? And that's one of my concerns, whether the feds would come in and take over either the county or the state system.
Between 2009 and 2016, there's been 6 states, and we cited them in our answers to the court's questions, and we listed them point by point, that have had class actions. I believe they were all state class actions, but I'm going to defer to Norm Reiner, who's more of an expert on that, because he's, as executive director of NOCTL, he's been involved directly in those. So I don't know the direct answer to that, but I suspect that at least one or two of them involve federal court. Yes.
Do you think there would be any benefit to your cause if the court were to raise the rates that are to be paid under 8102 and delay the raise in payment for, say, a year, to give the legislature then time to match that raise, if we did a good job of explaining why we were making the raise without directing the legislature, which I personally have a problem, as you know.
I do know.
Doing, yes.
Yes.
But if we set an example by raising it and then in our order explained why we were raising it and the concerns, and perhaps even put in some of the things that Justice Kelly and Justice Rebecca Bradley are talking about, that other states have taken dramatic action where they let persons who are arrested, supposedly based on probable cause, that they committed a significant law infraction, and trying to set an example and urging them to consider this example during the next session. So a delay with hopefully enough teaching in the order, would that be helpful, or do you think it wouldn't really accomplish anything?
Well, you're asking me to look in a crystal ball as far as how helpful it
would
be.
I know.
But to answer your question, I think it couldn't hurt. I think it would be a good approach. And I think if we look at 8102, and it's kind of a larger context about why it exists in the first place. If you go back, 8102 in its present iteration was established in 1994. And really, it was on the heels of the Dean case, where a defendant comes in and says, hey, I'm not eligible for public defenders, and the court won't appoint me a lawyer. So this court said, well, you know what? I know the legislature established this scheme about eligibility, but we, the court, are the experts. We're the ones that are running, we understand this, how this system works, and so we're telling our judges, this is what this court said, that you need to look at all the factors that go into indigency. And so the establishment of the rule itself, it seems to me, is your opinion, communally, of what is a reasonable rate. And in fact, in Friedrich, just a year after that, this court established the rule, this court said, yes, it went through an extensive analysis about shared authorities between the legislature and this court on what, you know, who's responsible for setting court-appointed rates. And this court said, yes, it's a shared authority. The legislature appropriates, but we are responsible for the administration of justice. And so we meet in the middle to kind of negotiate in a sense, but the court importantly held that we, you, this court, are the ultimate authority in setting rates. And that dovetails perfectly with the existence of the rule itself.
Yeah, but you know, so, the public defender's office does most of the appointments, and they're a totally different branch of government from us and from the legislature. So, you know, we have a little problem. I think it's easier to persuade this court what the court ought to do for those lawyers that it appoints, but much more difficult to get the court to use that constitutional, reasonable language that you have in your petition.
Chief Justice Rogensack, I completely understand your hesitation and your viewing this as a bright line between the legislature and the judicial branch. But if we go back in court history and in public defender history, for that matter, before 1977, the public defender was under the umbrella of this court.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Fitus versus Milwaukee County case, this court said, hey, public defender, we're having a problem here. We're having this dispute about who's going to pay and supply counsel for revocation hearings. And so this court said, well, we're ordering the public defender to do it, despite the fact that the public defender came to you in an amicus brief and said, hey, that's going to, like, explode our manpower requirements and therefore our cost. But the court ordered it anyways as a matter of public policy. And the reason is because you're responsible for the administration of justice in the state, and you didn't want to see the continuing devolution of what was going on. And that was in the 70s. Then that was when the public defender was under the rubric of the court. when it was moved to the executive branch, in the Hayes-Brook case in the mid-90s, this court authorized the, well, we already had the Supreme Court rate at that point, but a trial court said, hey, we can't find anybody at the public defender rate, we can't find anybody at the Supreme Court rate, so I, the circuit court judge, am going to appoint somebody at a higher rate.
Counsel, on that point, and I apologize if I missed this, what was the statutory authority for the court appointing an attorney at county expense?
I'm sorry, repeat that? Sorry.
What's the statutory authority for the court to appoint an attorney at county expense?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Do you know if there is a statute that authorizes the court to appoint attorneys at county expense?
I think that the court's orders through the Supreme Court rule is the only authority that exists.
Yeah. Thank you.
There's case law support for it, though, right?
Dean, for example.
Yeah. Dean, right.
But no statute.
What I was saying with Hayes Brooks before was the judge, and that she, the attorney, Ms. Hayes Brooks, submits her bill. The county board refused to pay it because it exceeded the Supreme Court rate. And the judge held the board in contempt, just like what happened in In re Courtroom. And this court said, that's a proper exercise of judicial power. So if this court is worried about telling a legislative body what to do, you've already authorized circuit courts to do that at the county level.
And we did it back in 1874 in In re Janitor, right?
In re Janitor,
the
yes.
The Supreme Court didn't have a janitor. The legislature wouldn't fund it.
Yeah.
The court issued a ruling, a decision, saying you have to.
And the reason
but a janitor probably didn't cost $64 million.
No, he didn't.
Not
you know what, Chief Justice? The janitor, if you read the case, the janitor was he wasn't just mopping up the floors. Mm-hmm. He kept the library. So he had special skills. And so the individual that ran the Capitol building at the time figured he had the authority to fire a critical part of this court's staff. And this court said, no, we're not having any of it. So that's the reason that was important. But it wasn't just In re Janitor. It was the Babbler. Hold on.
Barland.
Thank you. Barland versus Eau Claire County, where it was a labor dispute. But bottom line is that one of the circuit court judges, they removed his assistant. And this court says, you can't do that.
But what are the limits on our authority? I see your light is on.
Yes, his red light is on.
One of the issues are struggling. I don't know if somebody else can address that.
Okay.
Can I?
Thank you. Go ahead. You can answer Justice Rebecca Bradley's question.
What are the limits of our authority? Where does it stop?
That's a question this court has to make a judgment about. Really, what we've come to this court to emphasize that we're in crisis, as you found in 2011. 7 years later, it's only gotten worse. So your authority is to save the system. And if you see it imploding before your very eyes, as you do here, then you have to take action. And if you feel like it's not, if you feel like we're exaggerating, if you feel like this isn't really happening, then you don't.
I don't feel that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Now, I have Kelly Thompson on my list, but I don't see her. Oh, there you are. Okay. The State Public Defender, Kelly Thompson.
Good for you. Good morning, Chief Justice Rogan-Sack and esteemed justices. May it please the court, I am Kelly Thompson, the State Public Defender. I truly appreciate the opportunity to discuss issues related to the SPD reimbursement rate. I have submitted material to the court on which I would like to elaborate this morning. Although the petition primarily asked the Supreme Court to raise the rate of court-appointed counsel, it also does address the statutorily set rate of reimbursement the SPD can pay assigned counsel. And I'm going to try not to reiterate what's already in the written materials because of the length of time that people will be speaking today. But I do really want to stress the $40 hour rate is the nation's lowest statewide hourly rate. It has already been talked about the implications it has throughout the justice system, and I know, based on comments already made to the petitioners, that you are well aware of this. The SPD's private bar attorneys are essential to providing indigent defense in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's system is recognized nationally and internationally as a model because of its hybrid system of using both staff attorneys and certified assigned counsel. The low rate of reimbursement is having a significant and in some places dire impact on the provision of representation in conflict of interest cases handled by our partners in the private bar. The $40 per hour rate is inadequate, and I am respectfully asking for your help in getting it increased.
Counsel, the amendment to the rule would say that the $40 is unreasonable. What does that accomplish for you?
Your Honor, I believe what it does, it continues to move this argument forward. We know that $40, I can no longer find attorneys to take cases. We're down in certain counties with zero private bar attorneys. And in fact,
And just so you know, I completely agree with you. $40 is not reasonable. But what does us saying that get you? That's our sentiment. So we agree with you. That's not reasonable. What changes tomorrow as a result of that?
It doesn't change tomorrow, but it helps illustrate the issue. It helps highlight the issue, and it helps emphasize this issue to the legislature.
What response are you getting from the legislature? Because I know many people have approached the legislature for at least a decade or more. What response do you get?
Wasn't there even a bipartisan approach?
Yes. And in fact, in the last, I would say, 18 to 24 months, the problem, because it has gotten more pronounced, we've gotten more voices advocating for this rate, and we've gotten more interest from the legislature. Beyond just the fact that this has been one of our number one priorities in all of our budgets for the last decades, there's also been standalone legislation each session that has not been successful. But we have more people throughout the legislature that are getting involved, asking questions, and signing on, even the most recent legislative session, onto legislation to increase the private bar reimbursement. And that often becomes, and is happening not because of the work that I'm doing, I'm hoping it has some impact, but it really is hearing from other justice partners. It's hearing from the courts. It's hearing from the prosecutors. It's hearing from local county boards. We've had meetings with the entire judiciaries up north talking that they could go on all day about the issues in the criminal justice system and the needs and the resources that they have. But the number one issue right now is the private bar rate because of the length of time individuals we fear are staying in custody waiting for representation. And so I think this court's the acknowledgement from this court, not just privately but publicly, really does shine a light on this issue. This court has been wonderful in the past, advocating for resources for both prosecutors and public defenders and in systems needs. But this issue right now is coming to the forefront. It has been coming to the forefront. But we are in, I would say, nearing a crisis in the criminal justice system because of the length of time people are sitting without counsel.
Do you think the legislature fully understands how incredibly efficient the public defender's office is in the way it conducts business? You know, at least that's been my experience, that you are able to process, defend, and adequately represent people in a very efficient, streamlined way through your own office and through counsel appointed through your office, and I won't take up more of your time, but there are cost savings across the board that if you could quantify that for them, they may be in a position to realize the financial gain to be made by having an efficiently run system.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think what we've heard time and again from the legislators, it would be almost an easier discussion if they were against raising the rate, because then we would have a philosophical place to start. They're not. We are not hearing individuals saying we think the rate is just fine. We think we shouldn't be raising it. Individuals shouldn't have counsel. Those arguments are never said to us. The arguments, it becomes a priority. It's a funding because of the cost, and it's a prioritization during the budget process.
So I believe that we have legislators that are very sympathetic to this issue. I think they're hearing from their local, not just their local officials, but people in the public, and they recognize that this is an important issue. I think they've heard from the courts, this court as well as the local courts, about this is an issue. It's recognizing that we as a group, we must make this a priority, and that is what I'm respectfully asking this court to do as we go forward into the next session, making this our number one priority once again, that we have the court's support in recognizing and realizing that the private bar rate for public defender cases must be raised.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Norman Reimer, Executive Director of National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
May it please the court, I'm Norman Reimer. I am the executive director of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and a practitioner prior to that for 25 years. I want to thank the court for the privilege of allowing us to appear here, both on behalf of my association and for me personally, for reasons which I'm going to mention. I'm tremendously appreciative of this honor that you've accorded to us. I'm especially glad to be here because you are considering an issue that is really at the epicenter of a national crisis in public defense in this country, and you really have a chance to make a difference. Just a few words about our association. We are thousands of direct members, over 40,000 with affiliates. We're proud to be, to have the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers as our affiliate. We're here today. We've been working on public defense issues, as you can see from the papers, for many, many years. We do training, technical assistance, and reform efforts. We've written a number of reports. And I'm pleased to say we're actually working in Wisconsin. This year we're going to issue a pretrial justice advocacy manual, and we will be doing training in partnership with a public defender here as well as with the private bar. So we have a real stake in what you're deciding here today. Now, why is it important? It's important because of the magnitude of the crisis, because in Wisconsin, because it's emblematic of what's happening around the country, and because we have been searching for an answer to this problem for years, and we believe that the answer lies with the courts. Just this past year, my organization partnered with many others, from including prosecutors and academia, and we held a conference at the Monroe Friedman Center for Ethics called Judicial Responsibility for Justice in Criminal Courts. The courts are the answer to the crisis in public defense. There is an opportunity that this court has to really lead the nation, and I can tell you that the eyes of the nation are on what you do in this situation, because it's so stark, because the problem is so real. And I also want to be very clear, we are not here. I didn't come out here to Wisconsin, as much as I love the opportunity to be here in Madison, because we want lawyers to get a raise. We are here because people's rights are being lost, and it's affecting human lives every day. While we are sitting here today, while we are having this discussion, people are going to court and not having a lawyer or not seeing a lawyer. They're pleading guilty without lawyers, and it's having enormous costs on society.
You know, I read a lot of the information about people pleading guilty to misdemeanors without a lawyer, but no one said whether those folks were indigent. We have a lot of folks that come before the court on civil matters. They could darn well afford a lawyer, but they don't want to pay for a lawyer. Is there any data on how many of these people that appear without a lawyer are without the means to hire
a lawyer? I think part of the I would say the answer, Chief Justice, is this. We don't have hard data. The Sixth Amendment Center did two reports which were submitted to you, and they have had great difficulty in getting that data. But I will tell you this. We've worked in five or six states now and done this research, and I can tell you unequivocally, many of those people are indigent. Many of those people have no choice. If they are told, if you are a working person and you get arrested, and you are told that you have to wait a week or two or three for a lawyer, and you have a chance to plead guilty and go home, you are going to plead guilty. And so I actually would like to talk about this. By the way, I want to make this personal observation. I feel like I have to share this with you because it's so ironic when this came about. As I mentioned, I was very much involved in the private bar. I was a criminal defense lawyer, but I was very much active in public defense. I was the chair of the committee that oversaw the assigned counsel plan in New York City for a number of years in the late 90s and early 2000s. And we had exactly this problem. And through my work with a mainstream bar association, the County Bar in New York, we brought the case called Nykla v. New York. We were at that time in 2000 challenging the $40 rate in New York State. That rate had been in effect since the late 1980s. And we got a judge in 2003 to declare that it was unconstitutional. Had exactly the same problems you have here. We couldn't get lawyers. Those that we had were overburdened. They weren't seeing their clients. They weren't investigating the cases. And the court found that it impaired the judiciary's ability to function. So that really leads me to the points that I want to make that go beyond our written submission, which I'm sure you'll enjoy reading. But let me get to the heart of the matter. And I think in the context of it, without even having any forewarning of this, I think I'm actually going to be responsive to several of the questions that were raised. First of all, please look at the context in which this arises. This country is over-criminalized. We rely on our criminal justice system to regulate all manner of social, personal, and economic behavior. As a result, we lead the world in incarceration. We are with about 2.3 million people in jail. We arrest 12 to 14 million people a year. My understanding is that the statistics for Wisconsin are between 200,000 and 300,000 arrests a year. Just a week or two ago, former Governor Thompson gave remarks in which he said, and I was astounded to read this, 22% of adults in Wisconsin have a criminal record. We are also living in the age of collateral consequences. More and more people are recognizing that even minor misdemeanors have life-altering consequences for people. It affects family rights, the ability to get a job, education loans. The ABA has something called the Inventory of Collateral Consequences. They've identified 50,000. I looked at it in advance of my coming here, and I looked at Wisconsin. 70 pages, over 700 collateral consequences. So as a result, there is in this country a bipartisan consensus emerging about the crisis of the right to counsel. Eric Holder addressed it during his term as Attorney General on one end of the political spectrum. Think tanks like the Texas Public Policy Foundation, led by a fellow by the name of Mark Levin, have called the funding of public defense a core responsibility of government. And even, dare I say the name, Charles Koch, has specifically said that from his perspective, providing counsel to the disadvantaged is a critical responsibility of government. So this is beyond partisanship. It's really a national crisis. So I submit that there are three core reasons why you can and should act, and I'm going to suggest that you should act in a way that's a little bit more bold and a little different from what's in the petition. First of all, it goes to the nature of the right, the first reason why you should act, and the role of the lawyer. Both the United States Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution provide that in all prosecutions the accused shall enjoy counsel. It goes to the dignity of the individual. It is, in fact, the right to counsel is America's gift to the world. In the 1700s, it was unique. Now it is embodied in almost every constitution, in treaties, in covenants, in international covenants. But it's more than that. It's the important role that counsel plays in our modern criminal justice system. Lawyers are responsible now for holistic representation. It's no longer, if it ever was, the myth of trying to get somebody off on a technicality. We're dealing with people with all kinds of problems, substance abuse, mental health, and it's the lawyers who are most effective in trying to deal with that. Every judge that I have ever spoken with, and most of the district attorneys for whom I have high regard, and U.S. attorneys, will say to you, I want a good lawyer on the case. It helps me get to justice. And that's not happening in Wisconsin today. Secondly, and this is something that people don't really ever talk about, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is different from all of our other fundamental rights. It's not self-actuating. The First Amendment right to speak, to congregate, to protest, to pray how you want, it's fine if the government does nothing. The Second Amendment right to bear arms, regardless of where you stand on whether you should or shouldn't regulate arms. If the government does nothing, The right is protected. The Fourth Amendment right does require courts, but it requires courts simply to determine whether or not a search is reasonable, whether it meets whatever the tests are in the particular circumstances. But the Sixth Amendment right is nothing if it's not funded. It withers and it dies, and it's withering here in Wisconsin. So action must be taken. Finally, and this maybe goes right to the heart, I think, Justice Kelly, of what the point that you were making. The failure to ensure the availability of counsel is an attack on the judiciary itself. You, the courts, are responsible for the administration of justice. You have a duty to ensure that the rights of the accused are protected, that the victim has a forum, that the public has access to these proceedings, and that they are carried out in accordance with due process. The courts, properly functioning, are the glue that holds us together. Without those courts, and without the lawyers that make those courts work, we are lost. So you have to act. You must act. Because this is a direct attack on the judicial function of the state. And that's why action is required. And I've seen in your case law that I believe the answer is that the authority to appoint is an inherent power of the court. You have express and implied powers which allow you to ensure the sound operation of the judicial system. I think that's the exact language that I have read in some of the cases.
And if that's the case, do we have the inherent authority not only to commandeer the fisc of the counties, but also that of the state?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the commandeer. After commandeer.
Sure. If that is the case, that this is part of our inherent authority to do, apparently when we tell the counties to pay for attorneys, we're simply using our inherent authority.
Right.
So if we have the inherent authority to commandeer the fisc of the counties, do we have that same authority with respect to the fisc of the state?
My answer is that you probably do have that authority, but I don't even think you need to go there. I think, for one, I don't think you should declare this unreasonable. I think you should declare it unconstitutional. And stepping back two steps, I think you should raise the rate where you clearly have the authority to raise it. I think you should strike down the fixed fee contracts, the flat fee contracts, which I know the public defender has indicated that they're relying on them less and less, but they are in direct conflict with the ABA's 10 principles. They are not serving the cause of justice, and they shouldn't be permitted. But when it comes to the determination as to what the statutory rate should be, I'm sort of in the camp, I think, where the Chief Justice was positing as a potential option, that you ought to declare it unconstitutional. And
that wasn't anything I was positing. I would never declare anything unconstitutional without that claim before us, briefed and argued, which is not where we are today.
Well, I would say this to you, Chief Justice. You have before you absolutely no one contesting the fact that people are being denied their right to counsel regularly and routinely. So I do think, as part of the rulemaking authority, even if you didn't want to address the question of how much lawyers are paid, I think that a statement saying that this is a constitutional crisis and perhaps staying that in order to give the legislature time to act. I also think another option for this court, which builds off of what was done in Massachusetts, but as part of your inherent authority to maintain the operation of the courts, you could, and as I understand the power of the court in considering this petition, that you could adopt the rule as proposed, or you could modify it in whatever way you deem appropriate. It seems to me that you could have a rule that says that if someone doesn't get a lawyer within X period of time, they must be released. Or if they don't get a lawyer within Y period of time, the charges must be dismissed. It seems to me that that is an appropriate exercise of power. And it will, as Justice Kelly, as you have pointed out, it seems clear, since nobody seems to want to defend the $40 rate, it seems clear that without the action of the court, it's not going to change. And what we need in Wisconsin, what we need in this country, is a recognition that this right has to be respected. It's not just a piece of paper. It's not just a word. It's actual human lives that are at stake. And You know, we in this country, we pretty much invented the idea of the right to counsel. It's pretty remarkable that it's that the right is there for all accused persons. It's not there just for the innocent or the maybe innocent. It's there because it's understood that nobody should stand alone against the full might of the government, and no one should be left to languish without access to that right. But that's what's happening, and it has to stop. So I hope that you will consider acting in a way that will make it unmistakably clear to the other branches of government, to the people of the state, and to the people of the nation that the protection of this fundamental right transcends all ideology, that it is sacred, that it is timeless, and that it is irrevocable. I would also like to just point out, because the question came up, and Mr. Birdsall turned to me on this point, most of the recent cases have been litigation brought in state courts. There are a number of reasons why federal courts are an inappropriate jurisdiction in which to bring these cases, but these cases have been brought, and they have been brought in a number of states, Idaho, Washington, Pennsylvania, New York, not the one I was involved in, but even more recently, the Harold Herring case, all essentially class action cases. And you could wait for that day to come. It will take years. It will cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they'll spend it.
My question. What's the cost to the state to bring a class action lawsuit?
They have to defend it.
Okay, but what has the cost been in other states?
But from my understanding of the one that I was involved in, it cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars because they fight it all the way. It's not like it's a simple matter. In the case that I was involved in, there were over 60 witnesses. The case went up on appeal twice before it even got to the merits phase. All that time, the rights of people were still being denied. And in the end, they finally gave in, after the court ruled it unconstitutional, the legislature quickly acted to raise the rate. They didn't raise it to the rate that the court had suggested, but they raised it sufficiently high so that the suit was settled.
Have there been any states where those class actions have been pursued where it was not found to be unconstitutional?
I am not aware of any of these cases that did not result in a finding of a denial, one way or the other, of a denial of the right to counsel. All the ones that I'm aware of have resulted in some action. They get settled at some point. The legislature adopts a new system, but they bring progress. The problem, as I said, is it's the most inefficient.
So in each of the states, it's been a winner.
To my knowledge, that's, of course, remember, nobody's going to bring these in situations where it's not a bad situation. And here you have what arguably, with respect to some part of your public defense system, I agree, the hybrid system, the way it operates is wonderful. But with the rates so low that lawyers, it's not that they don't want to do this work, they can't do it.
In the other states where this has been brought, were the rates $40?
Well, in New York they were. In other places they're being brought simply because there's essentially unavailability of counsel for whatever reason.
At any rate?
Well, when the rates are raised to a sufficient level, you find that there are not only lawyers coming into the system, but quality lawyers coming into the system.
I'm just curious if you know where Wisconsin fares in light of those other cases, you know.
Well, this $40 rate is the lowest and was when we did our study 5 years ago. So, but you know, this is why, when I said at the beginning, we're looking to courts to come up with creative ways to address this. Because it's within your province, because the courts are the ones responsible for justice, we're looking at the reality that we can't seem to break the logjam. I mentioned in New York that lawsuit was brought. It was brought in 2003 for the $40 rate, which had been in effect for 12 or 15 years, and resulted in a rate of $75. Now we are in 2018, and it's still $75.
You ask for creativity. You also have suggested that this court consider declaring it unconstitutional. In other words, the situation that we face in the state has reached an unconstitutional level. You've heard hesitancy from this bench to embrace that request.
In 2011, when this court denied a similar petition, we said this: if this funding crisis is not addressed, we risk a constitutional crisis that could compromise the integrity of our justice system. So I ask you to be creative. Where, in between this statement, which says in 2011, we've got to do something or we will have a constitutional crisis, it's looming. Here we are now, 7 years later. Nothing has been done. So where in between that statement and declaring it unconstitutional can we land?
Well, Justice Bradley, I'm very glad you reminded me of that point, because to me, you know, I believe me, I understand and thoroughly agree with the hesitancy of any court to appear even to be treading on the turf of the other branches of government. But this is a situation in which 7 years ago you had a similar situation and you deferred. And you tried to send a message to the legislature.
I don't think it's just a matter of sending a message. It is what we are about. Normally, before we would declare something unconstitutional, we would have a case. We would have arguments. We would have briefing. So to declare something unconstitutional without that kind of framework is an anathema to the way we work.
That's why I understand that. I recognize, you know, the need for a case and controversy. But I also believe that the court's inherent authority to operate the courts allows you to fashion rules such as we talked about, where you simply say, without dealing with the rate, if you don't provide a lawyer, person has to be released. There's no authority to hold them.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for journeying to Wisconsin and giving us some of your thoughts on this very significant issue. The next person on my list is Marcy Rainbow. And she is from the Wisconsin Counties Association.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Marcy Rainbolt. I'm a government affairs associate with the Wisconsin Counties Association. So the Wisconsin Counties Association represents all 72 counties of the state of Wisconsin. And just in response to some comments that were made earlier and some comments that were issued to this court prior to today's hearing, to place the financial burden of this petition to increase it from $70, what we're paying now, the counties, to $100, in hopes of basically forcing the hand of the legislature to take action and change the rate statutorily for the state public defender's office, is both unfair and unmanageable for our counties. We are the only state that has a state-funded, state-administered public defense system that requires counties to pay a higher rate for attorneys when the state cannot find a counsel for the individual. And to increase the rate that we are paying, while the state public defender's office would be held at the $40, would increase the number of cases that we would then be responsible for. So not only would we be paying a higher rate, but we don't also have an increase in the caseload as well. We also use flat fee contracting in counties across the state. And to have that option limited and be unable to use it would put our budgeting at risk. And a lot of our counties use the flat fee rate not only to budget, but also to have the attorneys basically ready and on hand for when they need those people to represent individuals in our county jails. We are continuously asked as counties to do more with less. And to increase this rate on us would again put more fiscal burden on our counties to do to provide more attorney coverage when a state public defender cannot be found. So we believe that this petition should be denied and that the proper change needs to come first from the legislature, and that they should change the rate statutorily, and then the counties and the state public defender's office would be more in line.
Indeed, you, in your letter to us, you indicated the history, and you quoted from our prior order, petition filed 2010, I think we decided in 2011, where we indicated that We agreed, we said in that order, that this is an area of shared authority for the court and legislature, but we decline at this time to use our administrative regulatory process to effectively circumvent a legislative enactment. So then in the letter, and I assume now you acknowledge that this is something we could do, it's shared authority, mm-hmm. but you're asking us not to do it.
Yeah, I mean, we believe that the legislature is the first line in changing this rate, that the legislature should have the opportunity and should act. I mean, we're not denying that the rate is low. We're not denying that this shouldn't be changed. What we're saying is to fiscally put this burden onto the counties in hopes that the legislature would take action is just not fair to us. And we don't have an increase in our budgets because this increase would happen. We would have to do more with less. And all of our programs would be at risk, not just providing counsel for individuals, but also the other programs that the county provides to everyone.
You also said in your letter that you believe that it was the Wisconsin State Legislature's sole authority to appropriate funds. Is that still your position?
I would say that we believe that it should come from the legislature. The legislature has the authority to change the statutes and that they should take action to change the $40 rate set for the state public defender.
Is it the legislature's sole authority to appropriate funds?
I believe so.
Well, you're talking about two different things here, and that's where I'm going to just put on my trial judge hat again and talk to you about that. The $40 state public defender rate is paid through the state public defender for lawyers, for people who qualify for state public defender assistance, but they need to farm out the case for whatever reason.
Right.
Counties foot the bill when a judge appoints a lawyer for a person, a dean appointment, or sometimes, just for convenience sake, someone wants a lawyer, you can appoint a lawyer, they can repay the county. You can do it a variety of different ways. I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, and I hear what you're saying because I lived in that world and worked with our county board to properly budget enough to be able to do these kinds of things. That doesn't happen in every county, and I, for a variety of reasons. One of the issues, though, that I saw over and over and over again is the fact that judges are having to appoint lawyers at county expense mm-hmm. when people really should qualify as being indigent and thus provided state public defender appointments. It's been a cost shifting to the counties mm-hmm. over the years. So talk to me about the county's support for that notion, that the public defender ought to be supporting them taking more cases.
So in conversations that we've had with various members of our county family, we have found that there are definitely situations in which a person has qualified for a state public defender. And in some cases, especially in our northern counties where there's, you know, not as many representatives, attorneys up there, they... When a state public defender cannot be found, then the burden has been placed on the county to do so. Now, we don't pay the $40 hour rate. We are at $70 right. an hour. So when the state should be paying for it, we end up paying for it. And then we also have the dean appointment. So those folks that fall kind of between that crack of not qualifying for a state public defender but not really having the money to afford an attorney, we're paying for them as well. And then also the guardian ad litem, we're paying at a $70 rate for them as well. So... The $40 an hour rate for us does play a factor because without increasing that amount, that's the crux of the issue for us. Without raising that $40 amount, we're just going to have more and more of the burden placed on us. So not only at that $70 rate, but if this petition were to be approved and we were bumped up to $100, now we have more cases at an even higher cost.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Carla Esqueda, Dane County Clerk of Circuit Court. I know him, but I don't see him. Ah, there you are. Good.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. Hopefully my very brief remarks will please the court. Our position is roughly the same as articulated by the County's Association. It's a budgetary issue for us. The thing that confuses us about the petition is that the petitioners frame the rule change as having two specific outcomes. One, that the state public defender will be directed to pay $100 an hour to its attorneys, and that the state public defender should be banned from flat rate contracting. If approval of the rule was limited in its scope to just those outcomes, I wouldn't be here. I would be in full support of this petition. But what's not clear to us, and really isn't addressed in the petition, and frankly, I think a lot of the folks that commented on the petition prior to this hearing aren't taking into account, is that this may have an impact beyond just the state public defender, defense bar, and court triangle. So we're concerned about the budgetary impact if counties are having to raise the rates for non-SPD appointments, and particularly if we are prohibited from engaging in flat rate contracting with members of the bar for other case types. That's a situation where I can speak from the Dane County perspective. We have lots of attorneys who are more than willing to join our roster of contract attorneys for a variety of case types. And if it's not broke, we don't see a need to fix it. We would like to continue to have that.
You use a flat fee for guardian ad litem in
Dane
County? Yeah.
Correct. So we would just not want to lose that flexibility at the county level to try to control costs and control our budgets in that regard.
I would like just some clarification. I understood you to indicate that you were categorizing counties have to raise rate for non-SPD appointments. Did you mean by that that you have no objection vis-a-vis appointments for criminal cases, but you do have objection for the other class or action types?
So, not necessarily. So, the kind of cases we're talking about in the criminal realm are the dean appointments that we've been talking about. In Dane County, we have a contract for that, the Criminal Defense Project.
Mm-hmm.
People don't qualify for SPD representation. They can qualify for ours, and it's a contract.
What about the people that do qualify, but they can't find anyone to take the case?
I know that that is a
What's
problem.
What's your position on that?
Sure. So, again, that is certainly an issue that the legislature needs to attend to by raising that $40 rate. But that is not, at least in Dane County and many other counties, that hasn't yet become an issue.
Yeah, but you understand.
I understand that, and I've read
very much. You know, you don't have to.
I've read commentaries from northern judges, for example,
La Crosse County. I mean, weeks, couple of letters say months before people can get out.
Sure. I guess what I'd say to that is that's been the status quo. These counties have long experience with that unfortunate circumstance. They may have built that into their budget. The other thing I would point out is that the current rule says that the rate is recommended at $70 an hour or higher. Some counties, in fact, I noticed, mostly northern counties, do compensate their attorneys higher. One county, I think it's Washburn, compensates at $125 an hour. The current rule has that flexibility already built into it. One wonders if, as long as that or higher provision is in the rule, does the rule really need to be changed? Counties seem to be working with that.
What's the incentive for the counties to, the incentive for the counties was less when people were taking $40 SPD appointments because it didn't fall on you to pay that. Now it does fall on you to pay that, so you have increased incentive to get that rate raised. How can we help you have increased incentive to help them get that rate raised?
You're talking about the public defender rate.
Yeah. When those fall upon the court to appoint because the SPD can't find somebody at $40 an hour, it becomes a county expense. The county presumably is not sending their bill to the legislature for that, right?
Correct.
But they kind of should be, right?
Indeed.
I mean, it really is a legislative expense that is not being paid by the legislature. Instead, the counties are just paying them.
They are. I don't know what would incentivize that beyond perhaps what you suggest, that the circuit court judges perhaps take a harder line and try to do exactly as you propose. That would be an interesting exercise. But in most cases where this has become a problem, I think my colleagues are simply overspending their budgets. If you look at the survey done by the Wisconsin Counties Association, where many counties reported how much they're spending for court-appointed counsel and whether or not they have contracts, and most importantly, whether or not they are over or under the budgets appropriated by the county boards for these purposes, most of them are saying that it's over. And I think the county boards understand the circumstances. I am not aware of any boards passing resolutions right and left to urge the legislature to act, but perhaps they should.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Frank Deidinger, the past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I am an individual petitioner of this petition, but I am here today as the immediate past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and I am speaking on its behalf. Rarely, if ever, has a petition addressing such a significant issue had such nearly universal support among our profession, your profession. When I was running for the presidential office of this association, at nearly every event I attended, lawyers would come up to me and ask what the State Bar could do about the scandalously low appointed counsel rate. Or they would describe to me the damage that that rate was doing to our justice system. And I think it's fair to say that everybody who's run for this office has had the same experience, unfortunately, for many years. You received a letter from current President Paul Swanson. Following our customary format, he reported that by a voice vote of over 60%, the Board of Governors voted to support this petition. But I want to elaborate on that. After a very thorough discussion at our Board of Governors meeting, our more than 50 governors, lawyers from every part of the state, from every practice area, from every background, voted to support this petition, and there was only one dissenting vote. Yesterday, I was at the Waukesha County Bar Association annual meeting. It was very well attended. In his remarks accepting that association's Lifetime Achievement Award, Sam Benedict of the Public Defender's Office mentioned that this petition was up for hearing before this court today. And as the meeting was wrapping up, one of the excellent judges in that county stood and brought a motion to have the Waukesha County Bar unanimously support this petition, and they did.
Can I just ask you something? I mean, in light of what the counties have just said, and I don't want to, you've got a wonderful cadence there, but here's the practical reality potentially. If a county board has a pot of money and they have that to spend, and now they are spending increased funds on appointments, which may very well be justified, did the county bar and have others thought about the fact that it's not a never-ending pool of money? Court commissioners, that's an easy target. At least it was back when I was thinking about these. The thought was, well, if we're going to increase that, we don't have the money, we're going to eliminate your court commissioners. I mean, there's a fallout in the justice system if it's viewed that way. Now, what does the state bar propose to do with that kind of a consequence that'll have a direct consequence on people who need temporary orders or TROs or, you know, child support set or family support or initial bond hearings or things like that? What's the bar think when that's the consequence? This rises above other needs in the court system?
Well, certainly,
where do we go with that?
Certainly we all understand. Everybody here understands that this can have fiscal impact, that there's ultimately only one place, presumably from the public, that we can afford all of the things that we are trying to do. But there is this tension here between the fiscal impact that we all understand can be difficult, but can be managed, and the constitutional right to counsel. And this, I mean, we've already had this discussion at great length this morning. We won't need to repeat it, but it's obvious that we all understand that that is the tension. but we cannot look away from the first duty of this court. Our profession sees this court as its leaders, and we really need your leadership on this issue, whether it's, as we say, to send a message or to take action right now to avoid this situation. As a bar association, we are partly a trade association. We want our lawyers to be fairly paid for the work that they do. But the image we can't get away from, the reality we have to face, is never to forget the terrified accused, terrified of the prosecutorial power of the state, waiting and waiting and maybe never receiving effective representation at the risk of their liberty. We cannot any longer, after this state of affairs has persisted so long, believe reasonably that there are not men and women in our prisons, in our jails, deprived of their liberty, the ultimate sanction that this state can visit on one of its citizens because of this dereliction.
Thank you. I think we all agree that there is a significant problem here.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Martin Hine from Racine.
If it pleases the court. My name is Martin Hying. I've submitted two responses, but I've also gone through and read all of those that have been posted and just have a couple more comments. Many people in the comments talk about the impact of inflation regarding the economics of lawyer rates. But if you're doing the work the same way you did 30 years ago when those rates were set, shouldn't you have also identified and adopted some efficiencies to make it easier for you? For example, computers, portable technology, telephony advancements. Haven't any aspects of what you do become commoditized in the last 30 years? And there is a comment made about the $40 rate, that nobody would defend it. I will. If you set this at $100, never forget that the people you are being asked to help have a mean household income of $56,000 a year, which is $28 an hour. They would have to work 4 hours plus one to cover the taxes for 1 hour of a lawyer's service. 1 day of a lawyer's time is 1 week of their income. And Justice Ziegler, you had mentioned that the counties are paying this. I think that's a little misrepresentative of the law. Everybody asserts that the county's paying these bills, but the Wisconsin statutes allow the county to collect these dues from the litigants, even if the litigant is found not guilty. All they have to do is register with the Register of Deeds.
Believe me, I get that memo. We did that in Washington County for a lot of people. So I am not intending to misrepresent anything, but I fully understand what a county can do in that regard.
So a client who can't afford the mean rate of $251 an hour, who isn't eligible for SPD, and I believe SPD is about $12,000, is where the threshold is at and hasn't changed. Minimum wage of $7.25, that's $14,000. So if you have a minimum wage full-time job, you are not eligible for SPD.
That's right.
It's that simple from a mathematics standpoint. So these people would have to pay $100 instead of the $70 today. This argument shows that all we're concerned with is the lawyer's profit and not the stability of the judicial system or the client unless it's at these preferred rates. That's a 43% increase in the cost that these people have to face. There are ways we could fund this. All we have to do is ask the legislature to overturn the gross income tax exemption. That's millions of dollars that could go back into the state coffers to fund these 5% impact upon law firms. But if you're looking for money to pay for this, that's a very simple way to do it, and just work with the legislature. I believe that the legislature has the sole authority to appropriate these funds, and that as seven individuals and residents of the state, you're welcome to petition your legislatures, as everybody else in this room can, to ask that these things, these changes are put in place to affect or to fund this process. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jerome Butting.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jerome Buting. I'm one of the named petitioners in this matter. And I want to take this a little bit a different perspective from my perception of how I think the chronic underfunding of the defense function and how this court's failure to act in the past when it could have has had a broader impact on our entire justice system than might be readily apparent. And I think part of that goes to the public perception of fairness and justice in our court system. Nearly all lawyers and judges have decried for the last many years about the lack of funding for, lack of adequate funding for the court system. Members of this court have asked the legislature to increase judicial salaries, which are falling behind nearly every other state in the area. District attorneys complain about overworked offices and insufficient prosecutors. The public defender engages in this biennial battle to try and get adequate funding for their staff, and for 40 years now to try and get adequate increase in the private bar rate. And yet, most of these requests have fallen on deaf ears. Why is that so? I think it's in part because the other branches of government are losing respect for this co-equal branch of the judiciary.
And out of those other issues that you mentioned, where there is an apparent lack of funding, do we have the authority to demand that they receive greater funding?
I listened with interest to the court's concern about do you have the power of the purse. And I think this petition is not asking you to exercise the power of the purse. What this petition is asking you to do is to start with what you can do, and that is to raise the rates for appointed counsel under 81.02.
But to the extent that we are telling the counties they have to pay for it, aren't we exercising the power of the purse? We're just exercising the power of the county's purse.
No, what you're doing is you are exercising your judicial authority to raise the rate. It is then up to the counties and the legislature to decide how to fund that. So, for instance, in essence, I think what we would be doing here is creating a bit of a domino effect that will ultimately get the result from the legislature that we choose.
Do the counties have to obey us when we say pay them at $100 an hour?
I think they do, and what will happen is I sympathize with the county's plight. I'm not trying to pile on the county, but what it will do, it will incentivize them to exercise their lobbying authority and their constituents, that is, members of the public who will others. Services might suffer.
Yes, because this is a question of setting priorities. And if we tell the counties to spend $100 an hour and they have to obey us, then we're taking their hand and putting a pen in it and signing the check for them, aren't we?
They can choose to do it how they wish. So, for instance, when it comes to the counties, they can go to the legislature and ask for more money. The legislature may say, we're not going to give you more money, but we're going to reduce the overall cost by decriminalizing certain things where we now have to appoint counsel for.
So are you saying that the power of the purse does not include spending?
The power of the purse includes spending, but what this court can do is say what is the Chief Justice asked, I believe it was Chief Justice asked, or what good it would do if this court declared it unreasonable. And what it would do is it would set in motion a chain of events that would force the legislature to respect the judicial branch to properly fund the defense function, which has been chronically underfunded for so many years. If it's unreasonable, attorneys won't take it. Perhaps class action lawsuits would result. I don't think that's the most efficient way to do this for all the reasons that Mr. Reamer pointed out about how expensive it is and how many years it takes to get a remedy that way. But what has happened when the court has failed to act, how do we expect the other branches to respect this court's authority, co-equal authority to ensure that there's justice in the courts, if the court fails to act by granting this petition? I think it will only perpetuate the problems that we've had with the continual decrease, or at least decline, in the funding of the courts. So I think this court, I point out, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that justice must satisfy the appearance of justice as well. And I think the public recognizes that. And I think American people generally are fundamentally good, and they want to see that their courts are providing fair and justice to all of their citizens, including those who can't afford counsel. And they're not seeing it now. And there's good reason they're not seeing it now, because I think we are in a crisis situation that this court can remedy by acting now. And by the way, it's not just defendants sitting in jail that are without counsel that's the problem. Victims are suffering as well. Their ability to get closure, their ability to get a case resolved is delayed the longer that it's inefficient and there isn't attorneys on the side of the defense.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Judge John Anderson, Bayfield County Circuit Court.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Greetings from the far north. It's always nice to be here. I come here today, I sent a letter in. I'm not going to repeat my letter. I come here today speaking in support of the petition, recognizing, as you all do, that this whole problem has a whole lot of moving parts to it, and it's complicated. And what you do in one area may have an unintended consequence in another, and vice versa. And there are not going to be good solutions, probably, to the fundamental problem.
What do you pay in your county?
Pardon me?
What do you pay in your county?
We pay for the dean appointments and the county appointments $70 an hour.
Okay.
We were paying $65 for non-court time, road time, out-of-court time, and then $70 for in-court. It's just flat $70 now.
So do you see any fallout in your county? Do you have court commissioners? Do you have?
I'm a single-judge county, and we have court commissioners, but they aren't. They only take cases on a piecemeal basis. If I can't hear something.
So you don't have like a family court commissioner or something?
No, we're not that busy. So, will there be fallout if we increase the rate? Sure. The county collects, as most counties do, most of this money, not all of it, and not everyone is asked to repay if they're so indigent and financially strapped. Some just aren't asked to be paid. Some are paid at a lower, maybe a certain percentage of it. I think Bayfield County, the last statistic I saw, the clerk's office collects, after about 5 years, about 90% of all of the money that they are required to collect. And what I'd like to do, and this is neither in support of or in opposition to, but I did bring some exhibits along. And I think because this is what the court operations charts look like, what we are asked at the circuit court level to collect all the time. So I brought copies for everyone, and I think it's a good idea to
give them to our marshal, and she'll see.
Just to take a look at what we have to do and how much money we have left for any number of things.
Are you talking costs and surcharges added on to things? Is that what you're talking about?
Filing fees, surcharges, fees, court costs, all the things. And there's this wonderful chart, and you know when you look at it, it's a lot. It's a lot. There's no question about that.
You only get a fraction of that back.
And the vast majority of it goes to the state. And I'm assuming it's allocated in some budget process to fund a program that is court-related. I'm assuming that's how it works. I guess I don't know that for sure, but I'm assuming that's how it works. But, the question is, does the court already collect enough money to fund itself? I guess I don't know the answer to that. That's part of the data problem that I think you struggle with. Mm-hmm. And regardless of whether... Before I get to the main reason I'm here today, because something has happened in the last 2 years in my court and the courts in the far north that just is something new that I want to talk about before
well,
I'm done.
Well, you need to get to it because you have 5 minutes.
I got 5 minutes. So,
aside
from the money problem, this idea that we have people charged with crimes that are eligible for a public defender, and the public defender's office is taking 2, 3, 4, 6, 10 weeks to find a lawyer. And I have been asked, by the person or on my own, to then say, I can't wait any longer for the public defender's office to appoint, and I'll have to appoint on behalf of the court through a dean-style appointment. And when I do that, I will have to pay it at the county rate of $70. I can tell you that in some simple misdemeanor cases, some attorneys will take it at $70 an hour. Complicated felony cases, it's very, very difficult to find any attorney that will take it at $70 an hour. And then I'm forced to almost negotiate then to find someone, what will you take this case for? Now, 15 years ago when I took the bench, if you would have told me that that was going to be one of my roles, I would have said, that's crazy. That's not what a judge does. And now it's gotten to the point that before I actually go out and appoint, I'll call Kelly Thompson's office, and her office has been absolutely wonderful trying to address the problems of the far north and in other rural areas trying to find lawyers. And oftentimes her office can intervene and be of assistance, and sometimes they can find a lawyer and sometimes they can't. But we are at the point where I have people sitting in my county jail for weeks without a lawyer. I have not had that case. I've waited. I've wondered, is someone going to have a writ of habeas corpus to the federal court? Is someone going to bring a motion? But the trouble is, when there's no lawyer, there's no motion.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Ellen Hennick.
May it please the court, I'm Ellen Hennick. While I am the treasurer of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, I am actually here on my own behalf. I'm an attorney in Milwaukee. I was going to talk in part about the scope of the problem, but I think this court is well aware of the scope of the problem. What I think might be more helpful is I'd like to go back to this notion of what does the court have the power to do? I want to go back to the idea, what are the limits of the court's authority? Because I think that question's been lingering out here. Now, there's no question that things courts do clearly can affect and have fiscal impact on the state and on the courts. Certainly within the context of cases, I think we would all agree that courts can order damages against the state. It's happened. It's happened a lot of times. Can order damages against the county. All of those have fiscal impact. So the question isn't whether the court can have a fiscal impact, I think. It's in what context can the court do that. Now, this petition asks for several different things. The first one is that you raise the rate in this court's own rule. Clearly, if this court had the power to make the rule in the first instance, I think the court has the power to change that rule. I don't think that there's a whole lot of disagreement. Now, that may be a separate question from should they, but does this court have the power to change its own rule? I think most people would clearly say yes. Does this court have the power to make comments when it makes rules? It does it all the time. Does this court have the power to make statements in an order, as was suggested earlier, when it changes a rule? Certainly this court has assumed it's had that power for many, many years now. I don't think those are the really difficult questions. I think the more difficult question is, when can they perhaps influence, perhaps discuss, and when, somewhere down the road, if there is a lawsuit, can they say to the legislature that $40 an hour is not appropriate? I think that's a more difficult question. There's no question about it. But I think the case law says that there's a certain core, that the answer is you can do it when it starts to affect the core of the judicial function. And what's that distinction? Well, years ago when the legislature said, we're not going to pay $50 anymore, we're going to reduce it to $40, could the court have jumped in? And I think the answer is no. Why is the answer no? Because there was no evidence that that would necessarily affect the core of the judicial system. The question now, I think, for this court, in terms of deciding whether it can do something, is whether we are at the point where that $40 an hour is affecting core judicial function. I think the cases talk about whether it seriously burdens the judiciary. And when you look at it, that's the janitor case. And I apologize for not knowing the names of the cases. I've read them recently, but I didn't think I was going to be speaking on this. And as I've gotten older, I've gotten terrible with case names. The janitor case, why did that matter? Why could the court do it there? Because if they didn't, it affected their own library. If you don't have a library, well, at least before computers, if you don't have a library, you have a seriously impaired ability to deal with judicial research, which is crucial to making good decisions. What about the jury room? Again, I think what you're looking at is, if you don't have a jury room, how the heck do you have a jury that's going to be able to make the kinds of decision it makes in private, discussing things with other jurors? You can't. And certainly if the circuit court has the power to do that, this court has the power to do that, because this court was talking about it as the judiciary, not as the circuit court has particular power. Come back to the case in which counsel could not be found at the approved rate and the court wanted to pay more. Again, you can't have a case without counsel, much as we're trying at the moment in some counties. You can't do it. It doesn't work. So when you get to that point, yes, this court can step in and say, we need an attorney, and if that has a fiscal impact, well, it's really no different than damages. It has a fiscal impact. It's sort of subsidiary. And I think that that's the answer, and I see my time is up.
Yes. Thank you very much. Chad Lamy.
May it please the court. My name is Chad Lanning. I'm the president-elect of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Though I speak on my personal behalf, many other people have spoken already on behalf of Wachtell. But I will tell you that I'm concerned with the state of our judicial system right now, especially as it relates to the criminal justice system, but I'm terrified where it's going to be in 2 years. My term starts next month. In 2 years, my term will be over. And I am seeing the cascading results of the abysmally low compensation rates for lawyers that represent indigent defendants. It's starting up north, it's starting in rural areas, but it is snowballing. And that is the picture I have in my mind. This problem didn't start yesterday, it didn't start over the winter, it didn't start a year ago. It's been snowballing. There's a little snowflake at the top of a snowy mountain, and it's rolling downhill. And it's gaining momentum, and it's gaining mass, and it's, God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
And it's scooping up more and more people. And so the only real question we have is, how much damage is there going to be? It's causing damage now. I would say it's a crisis now. But the reality is, when that snowball hits the town at the bottom of the mountain, it's a disaster. And I think we have the ability to mitigate the amount of damage that's going to be caused if it's not addressed. And again, you know, Justice Anderson raised a very good point. You know, why aren't there legal challenges to Justice Kelly's question? Well, if there's no lawyer, there's no motion. When you have lawyers that are representing indigent defendants that are overburdened and not the most highly skilled lawyers. They haven't been grizzled. I'm not a grizzled lawyer. I'm not around as some of these other lawyers. I don't know everything they know. They don't do the challenges that it takes. And just anecdotally, you know, I recently got a call in the last couple months from a father crying. His son was in jail, adult son. And he went to go visit him, and he's, where's my son? Well, he's not here. He's in the hospital. What's wrong with my son? And, well, we can't tell you. HIPAA. So he calls me. What can you do? He had a court-appointed lawyer. So I called the court-appointed lawyer. Can you find out where your client is? He called the jail, and they said, we're not telling you. He said, okay. So he called me back to say, the jail wouldn't tell me where my client is. And he accepted that answer. I started lighting fires all over the place. You can't take no for an answer. But the bottom line is, with these types of situations at $40 an hour when you're overworked, you find that you take no for an answer sometimes. And it's kind of funny, Justice Rogan, Chief Justice, when you say that maybe we aim too low. We didn't ask that you find this unconstitutional. We aimed too low. And so I sit here and I think we blew it because we aimed too low.
I'm not sure that you aim too low. I think to hold the statute unconstitutional, you would never do that through a rule petition. It's just the wrong venue. If you want to do that, there are other ways of going about it, but that's not how you do it.
Well, I appreciate your consoling. But again, when you talk about priorities, and that's a big theme here too, priorities, is it any surprise that the lowest priority is indigent defendants? Is it any surprise? Who's advocating for them? Not enough people. We're trying. We're doing our best. I don't take public defender appointments. I don't take court appointments. And there's reasons for that, financial reasons. But the bottom line is nobody's advocating for them enough. And we're here asking that this court do what it can. I don't think we're over-asking. I definitely don't think we're over-asking. But we're asking you to do what you can. And so please support this petition. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Jeffrey with Nikki? Good.
Oh, I'll leave it where it is. May it please the court. Thank you very much. My name is Jeffrey R. Wisnicki. I am the Corporation Counsel for Kewaunee County. I'm also the Assistant District Attorney in Kewaunee County as well. And I serve as a governor on the Board of Governors for District 4 that represents Door County, Kewaunee County, Sheboygan County, and Manitowoc County. So thank you so much. I, again, am here not representing Kewaunee County, but on behalf of myself and as a representative of the Board of Governors. I'm here, some people have said they're here today not for a raise for attorneys. I am here for a raise for attorneys. I think it's high time that the Supreme Court take a look at the Supreme Court rate and give it a raise. I started in practice in 2003, so this is my, I'm coming up on 15 years. And I started as a general practitioner in 2003, and those rates that are today are the same as they were back in 2003. I remember as a young attorney taking these cases, the dean appointment cases, the public defender appointment cases, and at $40 an hour, it wasn't a very satisfying rate, but you took it for the experience. And at $70 an hour, well, that wasn't so bad. You got some good experience. And that rate hasn't changed in 15 years. So I'm here to advocate that the Supreme Court rate should be $100. And anything less than $100 is unreasonable. And finally, that as a representative legal committee, I am committed to this issue. I think we need a raise for our attorneys. I'm here to focus, and there's a lot of...
Counsel, perhaps you would... I entirely sympathize with you with asking for a raise for attorneys.
Yes.
I practiced for a lot of years, and I never had to practice at that rate. I think it would have been impossible for me to do that. But one of the earlier speakers mentioned the impact on the defendants. So at the current rate, either $40 or $70 an hour for the court appointments, the counties can ask them to pay that back.
Yes.
So when that gets raised to $100 an hour, and we are talking about people of very limited means, what's the impact going to be on them, and how should that factor into whether we should give attorneys a raise?
That's a certainly important factor to consider, but that's the cost of doing business. If it costs $100 to hire an attorney, that's what it costs. When we appoint an examiner in a mental health case, we don't ask them what the cost is, we appoint it. If it's $1,500, it's $1,500, and that subject might have to pay back that $1,500. If there's a guardian ad litem appointed in a family case, the court appoints a guardian ad litem, and the parties to that divorce action have to pay back the guardian ad litem. It's the cost of doing business. And I understand that by raising the rate, yes, the parties to the action are going to have to pay that back. But also, in my experience, when people come forward before the court, what can you afford to pay on a monthly basis? And we're very acceptable, agreeable to setting up reasonable payment plans so parties can pay that back. It's what it costs. Why should we expect that the members of our profession should have to take a loss in representing these people, is my view. I came here today to specifically address some of the specialty practice areas. As corporation counsel, I handle the CHIPS cases, TPR cases, GIPS, delinquency, mental health cases. I mentioned guardianship, protective placement. These cases are represented in a combination of their appointment through the public defender's office, and there are also dean appointments to the county. In Kewaunee County, we also pay $70 an hour. What I'm noticing is happening is that there's only a certain pool of attorneys that take these kinds of cases on. And when I started 15 years ago, that same pool of attorneys that I started with 15 years ago in Kewaunee County is the same pool of attorneys that takes them today. There are not young attorneys learning these very important practice areas. And the main reason why is there's not a private practice, if you will, for these specialty areas. Like the criminal defense world, you can have a private practice taking non-criminal cases. There really isn't a robust private practice for these specialty cases, and it's incumbent upon this court to set a fair rate so that we have young attorneys willing to take on and learn these important practice areas. As you know, these practice areas are very statutory and procedurally driven, and to be effective in these areas, you need to know the statute, you need to know the timelines, you need to know the rights that the individuals have in these cases in order to competently represent the individuals in these cases. And if I'm looking at taking on a case like that for $40 an hour, I'm just not going to bother learning that area of law. I'm not going to bother learning that area of law. At $70 an hour, I'm not going to do it. It's not worth it to me. The volume is not there. We need to compensate attorneys fairly to take on these line of cases.
And thank
to the
you.
Go ahead, please.
Yep, thank you very much. Your red light is on. And as I said at the beginning, I'm going to kind of move everybody along. Okay. Jeremiah Meyer O'Day.
Good morning, Your Honors. I hope it pleases the court. What I have to say, I started practicing as an attorney back in 2014, so much more recently than I think most other people who have spoken with you today. When I started with a small nonprofit law firm that was essentially, I took public defender cases to fill in. I also took a lot of civil cases, and I was being paid essentially on the same kind of basis that the public defender cases were. There were flat fees, they were very small, and they varied depending on people's income. And that was fine for a while. I did not have any children at that point. Shortly, children began to come, and it became impossible, even practicing out of an office that cost $200 for everything and without an assistant, it became impossible to survive on the amount of money that could be made there. And we're talking like $40,000 in a year that I had spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000 in educational costs to get the privilege of earning. I will now shortly be back in private practice again, and I've taken thousands of public defender cases, most of those as an assistant public defender, but I'm not here to talk about that. What the problem is, when I go back into private practice, I would like to take public defender cases, but I will have to severely limit them. Because as a business decision, it makes no sense to take a large number of cases that you actually have to pay for the privilege of working on. And that's what will be happening. That's unacceptable. Now, speaking to the question of power, it's been brought up a number of times, whether you all have the power to order the legislature to come up with a better rate. I think you do. Gideon is a perfect example of that. Gideon is the U.S. Supreme Court ordering every state's legislature you're going to spend a lot of money. You're going to spend a lot of money on attorneys for indigent defendants, and you're going to do that because it's required by the Sixth Amendment. It's required by the individual dignity of each and every person you propose to incarcerate. And I think that's what the court should keep in mind when they're thinking about what kind of power they have. The court absolutely has the power to order the legislature to live up to its constitutional obligations. And I would ask that you do so.
Very good. Thank you. Brian Bennett.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. I'd like to talk about two things today: how appointed counsel pay directly affects access to justice for the indigent, and how this issue impacts the practice of law in rural areas. I'm a small-town lawyer living in Rhinelander. I take private cases, court appointments, and a few major felonies from the public defender. I don't have a cabin up north. I drove here in a 17-year-old truck. I haven't been on an airplane since 2006. And I'm okay with all of that. A friend of mine likes to say that in the North Woods, we work twice as hard to make half as much and live three times as well. I was born and raised in Rhinelander, graduated there in 1988. By 2003, I found myself in Washington, D.C., carrying somebody else's briefcase and hoping in 10 years to get some actual courtroom experience. My wife and I weren't living the life we imagined that we would live. So we came up with a new life. We went home. So I reached out to Ann Munninghoff at the Public Defender's Office in Rhinelander, and I said, Ann, is there work there? She said, yes, yes, there's work there. Get here now. So in February of 2003, I took the bar exam, and I started my office in gym. And I mean, it was an office. One room, no window. By the end of the first year, I'd accepted about 40 cases on appointment. The second year, 135. The year after that, 168. I put 20,000 miles a year on my 1991 Ford Festiva, chasing cases from Florence all the way down to Wausau, almost exclusively on SPD files. But how could I do this at $40 an hour? A better question is, how could I do this at $25 an hour, spending 500 hours a year driving the little Ford Festiva? And the short answer is by doing without. I went without health insurance at times. There were Christmases where only our son got gifts. My wife did the books at night and on the weekends, and we nursed our vehicles well past when most folks would have replaced them. We did finally purchase a home, but that's because I'm a veteran who qualifies for a VA home loan. Now I share an office suite and a staff with a few solo attorneys, and we've got room for a few more. Our operation is lean, but it's worked for about 10 years now. And the simple fact is that our tight budget can't take $40 an hour. The only way an attorney can survive on appointments up there is by taking so many cases that cannot give adequate representation, which is the situation I found myself in about 10 years ago when I decided to forcibly trim myself down to 100 cases a year. So now, north of Wausau, I'm one of the very few private bar attorneys willing and able to take A, B, and C felonies for the state public defender. That includes, at this moment, 2 attempted homicides and 5 sex assaults. And as you probably heard already, the offices are calling 50 or more attorneys to get somebody to come up to Rhinelander, Forest, Lang Lake to take those cases. I have to pay the cost of the business that go along with running my practice. And when I'm not in the office, I'm still paying for staff, rent, health insurance, which means when I am in the office, I better be billing for more than $40 an hour. I provide my clients the best defense that I can. I provide for them insight into a tight-knit community of attorneys, judges, and clients who see each other not only in court, but at their children's concerts, at the grocery store, at church, local community events. And it's a good life, but it's dying. And it's dying largely in part because we can't get young attorneys up there. The few young attorneys who do come to Rhinelander, they generally work in the public sector and then leave because they don't think they can make a living on the private side there taking appointments. And this is where our problem comes into focus. All of us who take SPD cases did the math. And we figured out that we had to increase our private caseload in order to pay our expenses. That means saying yes to the client who can come up with $2,500 for his OWI-2 and no to the indigent guy who can't even come up with $1,000 for his cash bond. I chose to be a small-town lawyer. I do not regret that decision, but economic realities exist even for small-town lawyers, and those realities directly impact access to justice for the indigent. My goal in coming here today has much to do with ensuring attorneys are reimbursed for their work at a realistic wage, as it does with making sure the accused have access to an attorney with a local phone number who can drive 5 minutes to the jail to visit him, who understands how the judge he's appeared before 100 times expects a case to proceed. When the accused is assigned counsel who is practicing out of his car with a home office and a telephone number and a different area code altogether, justice isn't being done. And as it stands right now, for many accused in the North Woods, that's exactly what's happening. This raise isn't about attorneys. It's about access to justice, and when we can provide more counsel to more indigent people, the court system will move along more efficiently. Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you, and thank you very much for coming here today. Timothy Andringa.
Good morning. Again, my name is Tim Andringa. It is, again, a privilege to be addressing the justices of the Supreme Court on such an important topic. Being one of the later attorneys, a lot of my thunder has been stolen this morning. I have my family in attendance, so I'm going to have to kind of ad-lib this now. I'm going to start at the end. Yesterday, one of the attorneys in my office sent me a notification that it's time, the 15th of May, to apply for my I think it's the Wisconsin Child Sales Tax Rebate. I have 2 children that qualify, so I'm eligible to receive $200 back from the state of Wisconsin on the almost $400 million surplus. I don't think today we have to worry about where the money is going to come from. There's a approximate $400 million tax surplus, and I believe the logic behind that is, or the reason for it is, due to sound fiscal management and a strong economy, Wisconsin has almost a surplus of $400 million, and part of that surplus is being returned to us in a child sales tax rebate. I don't mean to belittle this. I don't mean to sound coy, but the fact of the matter is that there is a $400 million surplus, and as I understand it, the annual increase from $40 an hour to $100 an hour results in a $32 million reallocation of some of this surplus. The money's there. I paid it. You paid it. We all paid it. I think, Justice Kelly, to answer kind of your question with regard to the constitutional crisis and why didn't somebody bring the lawsuit, I think it was answered by one of the judges that was up here before, and the attorneys. What happens? The judge makes a phone call to the bar, and the criminal bar steps up. That's why it hasn't reached that constitutional crisis, because judges are reaching out and going above and beyond, and the criminal defense bar is going above and beyond. That's why we haven't reached that constitutional crisis, and that's why it's not here before this court in a different procedure or venue. It doesn't surprise me, and I don't think it surprises anybody in this room, that the criminal defense bar and the judiciary work tirelessly to avoid it breaking down so miserably that it results in a lawsuit, because that's our job. That's what we do as lawyers. We try to avoid coming before you. I'm asking that you grant the petition. I'm asking that you grant them a raise. I graduated in 1990 from Marquette Law School. I first started at $60 an hour. I think you have my handout, also given the marshal another handout. I'm an economist. I graduated from University of Wisconsin back in 1987 with an economic degree. I could do the same thing, Justice Ziegler, I believe, for the county system and go and look at all the raises that have been granted to county employees since 1977 to present and I believe we would probably show a large percentage, albeit less so for many. But still, they have received raises since 1977. It's time, it's necessary to raise the rate. $100 an hour, I charge $310. I started at $60. I prosecuted cases representing many different municipalities in the state of Wisconsin, both for OWI first. That was my second jury trial, was prosecuting OWI first. I have defended criminal defendants. Not anymore. Justice Ralph Ramirez, the last time he saw me in a criminal courtroom, thought I was lost. That's when I kind of realized it was time for me to step out and do complex personal injury litigation and other complex litigation. But the fact of the matter is you cannot make a reasonable living. It is an abysmal rate. Justice Kelly, you said it, and I have it quoted right here in my speech, and I showed it to my daughter. Probably due to the abysmal rate is why I don't know appointed public defenders in Waukesha County. Yeah. I know Greg Rothstein. I know Mark Powers. I know some of the public defenders, Sam Benedict, Tony Rosario, Beth Weathers.
So, Mr. Andringa, if it were up to me, I'd give you a raise today.
Well, I don't need a raise, but they do.
And I would give them a raise as well because of your presentation.
And make sure your family knows that.
They heard it.
They're back there smiling. I could pick them all out.
So, and yes, there appears to be a surplus with the state, but do you have any thoughts on what authority we would have to tell them how to spend that?
I don't believe you have the authority to tell them how to spend it. I believe you have the right, though, to grant the petition and mandate it to go to $100 and let the county and the state work it out between themselves how they're going to disperse the remainder of that $400 million surplus after they do something with my $200 that they're giving back to me that I don't want, and I'll happily give it to the public defender's office for the appointment of this matter. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing your family, by the way. We have a court with class program that we run, and we always enjoy having young people come to the court, so thank you for bringing them along. Suzanne Edwards.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Edwards. I have been practicing for almost 15 years, primarily in Iowa, Grant, Richland, and Crawford counties, although I have had some work in Dane County as well. I have done trial work, jury trials, the CHIPS variety, felony cases, misdemeanor. I've done appeals, civil and criminal appeals. I just want to, I don't want to go too much into my dismal financial situation after taking mostly public defender cases, but I do want to talk about how the financial situation affects my clients. A few years back, the public defender expanded or updated their eligibility requirements. And there were more people that qualified for public defender representation. The effect in, particularly in Iowa County, is that the number of court appointments decreased. Court appointments for criminal cases are pretty rare out where I practice because everyone is getting absorbed into the state public defender system. Another thing that's happening, which I didn't anticipate when I first started my practice, is people don't pick up the telephone to look for an attorney. The first thing the trial court judge says is, have you contacted the public defender's office? No? Well, here, there's the number on the counsel table. Come back and then let me know if you didn't get appointed counsel, and I'll give you one of ours at $70 an hour, but you got to pay us back, or we're going to hunt you down, or we'll take your boat, whatever. still, I don't get the phone calls, except when we have certain judges, particularly in Grant County, that tell defendants you need to make so many phone calls and come back with a list of how much the local attorneys are going to charge for a retainer. Well, I hate those phone calls. because I know they're not calling to hire me. They're just doing their homework to get the $70 an hour appointment. Now, the counties don't want the rate increase, but they have a mechanism for collecting that the state public defender either doesn't have or doesn't utilize. Lots of people qualify for public defender representation because they're incarcerated or maybe out of work or got fired. They get out, they get their job back, they start earning again, but they don't get removed from the rolls. So there's a lot of mismanagement, I think, of the funds in general. For me now, since the expansion of the eligibility and the decrease in court appointments in criminal cases, I changed to doing criminal appeals, which are probably 99% state public defender appointments. I've had one case that came through the circuit court, but for the most part, they're public defender appointments. Now, my opponents at the AG's office, they have an office, which I don't have. They have staff. They have computers. They have printers. They have papers, paper galore. They have toner. All these things. They have Westlaw. All these things I don't have. Even my colleagues at the state public defender's office, they have free I'm paying for it. They get Westlaw that I pay through my tax dollars that I can't access. They have Books Unbound. They can look at all the books, the bench books. There's a lot of good stuff in those bench books, but I have to pay for that. I have to pay for malpractice insurance. I have to pay for internet. We have e-filing now, so these aren't optional things. And even with the state public defender, when I submit my bill, it goes into the abyss. I don't know, comes out the Wayback Machine, maybe 90, 100 days later. So I don't even have the cash flow anymore to order briefs, which directly affect this court and the Court of Appeals. I have to print them at home and hope my printer doesn't blow up because I don't have the cash flow to pay a $300 or $200 printing bill. But my opponent has all this stuff without even thinking. So out of my 40 or even my 70, I have to take all of this out. How this affects us in a larger sense is that for attorneys like me, we can't pay back our law school loans, which is going to have a huge impact down the road because that 40 or that 70 gets cut into so many pieces that we're going to have a lot of people who can't pay back their loans. So I'm just here to share my experience, and I appreciate your patience in listening to me.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming and talking with us. Emily Bell?
May it please the court. My name is Emily Bell, and today I am here to implore you to take whatever action you can to raise the appointed counsel rate. I've been an attorney for 9 years, and about half of those I've been focusing on criminal defense. I recently opened my own practice, but before that, I was with a really well-established criminal defense firm for about 5 years. That firm did not take appointed cases because with overhead, it would actually lose money on the appointed cases, and as Justice Ziegler pointed out, they were not able to bill the legislature or the county for that time. However, at this firm and under the guidance of more experienced attorneys, I learned many important skills, including how to conduct an appropriate and thorough investigation and how to manage a caseload, how to manage client expectations, and really importantly, how to try cases. At this firm, I tried on average a case every other month for the entire time I was there, which means that in the last 5 years, I have about 7 times the number of jury trials that you need to take felony appointments under the public defender system. Now, I could tell you how, in my fledgling practice, where I share an office with 3 other firms and have no staff, I can't afford to take public defender cases. I could tell you how I would be in a financially better position to take a law school-style clerk position than I am to take public defender-appointed cases. But that's not really what I want to tell you. What I really want to tell you is how, now that I'm going out on my own, I have the experience to analyze, to analyze technical evidence and also to bring sophisticated legal theories. These skills are necessary even in simple misdemeanor cases. And misdemeanors, as we know, can be appointed to attorneys straight out of law school who lack that experience and don't have the guidance to know what to do, how to analyze a case, how to try a case. And I want to tell you how this lack of experience plays out on jury trial day in Milwaukee County. In any misdemeanor courtroom, there'll be a list of 20 cases that are all scheduled for trial. And frankly, I can look down that list as I'm trying to decide whether or not my case is actually going to go. And I know if I see a private bar appointed case, chances are really good that that case is going to settle, regardless of the merits. And I know this because the more accomplished attorneys simply aren't going to take those cases for $40 an hour or even the $60 or $70 an hour that the county might pay. So instead, you're getting young lawyers who can't afford to take them because they're working out of their apartments or whatever, but they lack the experience and they lack the mentorship that you really need in order to be able to analyze a case, look at the merits, decide if this is a case that should go to trial, and then try that case. So at the current rate, experienced attorneys simply won't take these cases. But even more so, they can't afford to have their associates take these cases. And what that means is, as has been pointed out by numerous people before now, we are having a Sixth Amendment crisis right now, but we will have one in perpetuity because there simply isn't the system to create the next generation of good criminal defense attorneys. Our citizens deserve better than this, and our justice system demands better than this. And so today, I implore you to take whatever action it is you can to raise the appointed counsel rate so that experienced attorneys can afford to take these cases and they can afford to train the next generation of criminal defense lawyers. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for coming and giving us your views today. We appreciate it very much. Tim Kiefer?
May it please the court. My name is Tim Kiefer, and I have two perspectives that I believe are relevant to this issue. My first perspective is that I work as a criminal defense attorney. I am in private practice, and a small part of my caseload consists of SPD appointments. I want to be clear that an increase in the SPD rate from $40 to $100 could financially benefit me, although even at $100, the SPD rate would be about half what I charge my private pay clients. I take SPD cases not because it makes business sense, because it doesn't. But rather, I do it because I love the work and I feel it's a public service. Nevertheless, I still have to turn down the vast majority of SPD cases that I'm offered simply because I can't afford my overhead at the $40 an hour rate. My second perspective is that for the past 6 years, I have served as an elected member of the Dane County Board of Supervisors. I was reelected to a fourth term last month. And in fact, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is the justice who swore me in for my fourth term, along with the other members of the Dane County Board. With regard to county government, I am aware that both the Wisconsin Counties Association and the Clerks Association have raised concerns about this petition and its potential effect on county governments. While I do strongly support raising the SPD rate to $100 per hour, I also ask that it be done in a way that mitigates any financial burden, unfair financial burden, on county government. We in county government are well aware of our financial responsibilities with regards to both criminal justice and the court system. To give just one example, counties are required by state law to build and maintain a county jail. And here in Dane County, we are about to embark on a massive renovation of our county jail that will cost tens of millions of dollars. And we recognize that's part of our responsibility as county government. By contrast, providing public defenders for indigent criminal defendants has never been a required function of county government. That burden falls on the state government. Under the current system, counties are required to pay for the appointment of lawyers in certain non-criminal cases, such as county-appointed guardians ad litem, In some counties, including Dane County, have voluntary programs in which the counties choose to provide county-funded public defenders as a supplement to the state public defender program. This is designed for people who are low income but make a little bit more than the SPD income limits. However, I think it's what's clear in this hearing is that the main issue at stake here is the $40 an hour SPD rate, which is a state issue, not a county issue. As this court is well aware, the public defender rate is set by state statute, and that's been discussed by previous speakers, so I won't get into the details on that. The rate for court-appointed lawyers is found in the SPDs, or the SCRs, I should say. And because we're here in a rules petition, that's why the SCRs are the focus. And regardless of these procedural issues, however, the state government is far better equipped to take on the financial burden of an SPD rate increase than our county governments. Because of revenue caps that have been imposed on county governments by the state, county governments are effectively prevented from raising taxes to pay for operating expenses, such as appointed counsel. The state, by contrast, has no such limitation and has many more options for how an increase in the appointed counsel rate could be paid for. In closing, therefore, I ask you to please increase the SPD rate from $40 to $100 and to do so in a way that mitigates any financial impact on county government. I would particularly direct the court's attention to the May 3, 2018 letter from the petitioners to this court, and that was in response to the Wisconsin Counties Association, in which they make several suggestions in response to the WCA's concern, including one option of making this rule change effective July 1, 2019, i.e. about a year from now, which would give both county government and state government time to prepare for the change as we go through our budget processes. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Theodore Kafkas.
Good morning. Excuse me. Yes, my name is Theodore Kafkas. I'm an attorney, and may it please the Supreme Court and be of benefit to the state of Wisconsin. I've changed what I'm going to say today after hearing your questions and after hearing others speak. I'm going to speak very briefly within 5 minutes about why I believe there has not been change, what has been the result, why there's a need for change, and also money. My understanding, Honorable Gary Sherman, when he was Wisconsin State Bar President, he was threatened that if he led a boycott of the fees, that he was going to be prosecuted. And also, so why has there not been change? Well, we can't unionize. We can't boycott. Why isn't the legislature and the governor made a change? My feeling, they have a monopoly on a market. Guardian ad litems, where are you going to get an appointment except by the court? They can set the fee. They are the fee setter. Likewise, they have such a market control on SPD cases, large portion of criminal defense cases, that they can set the fee, and they're controlling it with the market power they have. I also believe, so I think there's an element of exploitation which is unconscious or conscious, but many of them aren't attorneys, and they don't see the need, the constitutional need. My own attempt to even look at petitioning this honorable court and maybe even the circuit court, when I did a public records request in Milwaukee County trying to go back at what the fees were in historically. And after I mentioned in an email that I was looking into petitioning, making a possible petition, I feel I was treated terribly. So why aren't people coming forward? Well, there's a lot of reason not to come forward. I've withdrawn my name from the Milwaukee County guarding that item list. There was even an issue after that about whether I could, how I requested copies on a case, which is when you're an attorney and you're representing somebody on a case, you may need to get some reasonable copies. So what has been the result? The result is a threat to the Constitution. Years ago, I started to see more and more that attorneys were becoming plea counsels. They were not being defense counsels. And in guardian ad litem, my own, I'm going to give you one example quickly today that I've seen illegible psych reports. And when I mentioned that psych report is illegible, I couldn't read it. And in the office I was at the time, nobody could read it. The doctor quit after I mentioned that it was illegible and seeing if I could get a legible copy. So how many other guardian ad litem attorneys were just rubber stamping when there was an illegible report? So this is the result is that there's a threat on the Constitution because you're not having real representation. Why should the Supreme Court change the Supreme Court rules? Well, just like an engine needs oil, and the dashboard goes on when there is low oil, the engine will be ruined. The Constitution needs attorneys to be a voice, and when they're diluted, because there's financial and other pressure, not to raise the rights of those that are allegedly incompetent or alleged to have committed a crime. The Constitution is being suffered because when it's not represented for one, it's not represented for us all. Criminal thinking also comes about because people that are being charged with a crime say, they're not giving me my rights. I was not given my constitutional rights. I was treated wrong. When they say that, they come back and they find that they didn't have a voice, they didn't have a defense, and they were railroaded, and they feel that our Constitution, our highest law, wasn't followed, so why should they follow the law? We have to protect it. You have the power to set the guardian ad litem fees absolutely clear in my understanding. Also, I believe you do have the constitutional power to set these fees. I see my time's up. I believe there's money there. Thank you very much, Justices.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come and talk with us today. Ben Kempinen.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Ben Kempinen, and I assure you that I have had practice of being the last speaker and trying to teach law school classes near lunchtime, so I will do my best to stay within 5 minutes, or I'll expect everybody to get up and leave, even as I continue to speak.
That won't happen.
I'm honored to appear before the court today, and I'm encouraged by the overwhelming interest, both by the other witnesses, petitioners, and I might note I am also one of the co-petitioners, and with the hope that a wide variety of opinions will allow the court to act in a way to move us forward on this most vexing of problems. My perspective is going to be a little different, one of somebody that has had the privilege of working for more than 40 years with law students and young lawyers, many of whom I've had an opportunity of continuing contact and have watched the trajectory of their careers. I would say that although my comments are informed by my work at the University of Wisconsin Law School, I hasten to add that the comments are mine alone and don't represent the opinions or views of the law school or the university. I've seen firsthand what I think are the negative consequences of our failings. And as a system, and I certainly don't visit responsibility on this court, but for all of us in this profession, we have failed. We have failed the most needy in our midst in failing to provide legal services. Because I think, as we all are aware, the most important of our fundamental rights may be the right to counsel. because only when that is preserved do we have a mechanism to assert effectively other rights that we might be given by virtue of the Constitution or statutes. For many years, every fall, I would be excited to see a group of young, able law students. In fact, when I was on the admissions committee, I often felt that their resumes and preparations for law school suggested that maybe I shouldn't have been admitted when I once applied. And I've been honored to have a chance to try to teach these students and give them an opportunity to use their skills and their gifts, not only to make a living and pay their student loans back, but to make our system, our profession, and our communities better. We've taught them the importance of public service, that our profession carries with it not only privileges, but responsibilities to serve. We teach them that we, perhaps more than any other profession, are guardians of the rule of law, that core principle that we all stand equal before the law. We teach them of the precious constitutional and statutory rights they have that are guaranteed by our state statutes and, more importantly, by our state and federal constitutions. And we also teach them the importance of fair process, because I think, as we all know, frequently fair process has a greater impact on the community's perception of the fairness of our institutions than outcomes. And with that, we send them out to do what they will in their careers. And in fact, last week, our most recent group of graduates from Wisconsin celebrated their graduation. Sadly enough, we know, I know, and I think we all do, that when they confront the world of practice, they see a very different world than we suggested is possible in law school. They often learn that public service isn't valued and that those that choose the path cannot survive. I don't know how many former students, bright and able people, lived with their parents, were supported by their spouses, had part-time jobs, although I have to say I hadn't heard of any of them grooming pets, which would be one of the opportunities. They learned that equality before the law, the core of the rule of law, basically is a reality only for those that can afford it. And I think every one of us in this room, if we were in trouble, if a loved one was in trouble or faced with a difficult situation, we would not hire a new grad who is practicing out of his car and making $40 an hour. And this is not meant to criticize those people that do that. That is just a reality I think we all know and we all face. But there is an ever-widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, certainly not only in society, but in each and every one of our courthouses throughout the state. In fact, I imagine during the course of this hearing this morning, there's a number of people that are sitting in jails in Wisconsin because they're not because they're a bail risk, but because we can't find a lawyer to represent them. Or someone might have had a viable defense that wasn't asserted because their lawyer was not able to have the time and resources to research it. Our students also learn when faced with practice that meaningful expression of their fundamental rights of their clients is linked to adequate representation, something that we don't provide. And they also learn that inadequate resources invariably means inadequate process. And this is a state of affairs that I think we all know weakens respect and confidence in our justice systems. Well, what are the consequences of this? Well, for many, many judges, many prosecutors, many private attorneys, public defenders, they remain steadfast in their commitment to do their best, even in the face of unrelenting odds against it. And I think many of them have spoken here. We know many of them, and I think they are a constant inspiration to all of us. Others, an increasing number in my experience over the trajectory of my career, ultimately succumb. They succumb to the pressure, the tasks that seem to have no solution to do them possible. And the idealism with which we sent them out into the world of practice is replaced by cynicism. And their hope in equality is changed into basically the acceptance that it's not attainable, it's not achievable, and it's not something worth striving to achieve. The consequences of this not only pose grave and immediate challenges to those persons represented by lawyers with inadequate resources, but I suggest to you it creates an even greater risk to all of us. In a time of decreasing confidence that our courts and institutions can be fair and can guarantee those rights and the rule of law that guarantee equal treatment, we cannot afford to have our profession, the ultimate guardians of the rule of law, come to believe that fairness is truly beyond our grasp.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. He's the last speaker that registered. I'm going to ask Attorneys Birdsall and Schultz if you want to say anything in conclusion, but let me just see if there's anybody that came to speak and forgot to register or didn't have a chance to do that. Okay. Well, then, if one of you would like to come, if there's some comments you may want to make, given what was said, you had a lot of supporters, but you had a few that were not in favor. So,
how much time do I have?
Why don't you give me 5 minutes again?
5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay. I would say that almost all were supporters, for starters, except for the counties, which I completely understand. And they're absolutely right. It's an unfunded mandate. In fact, the existence of the rule is an unfunded mandate. The existence of the rule is also this court's opinion about what a reasonable rate is, consistent with the Friedrich decision. So, Justice Kelly, you were asking about what's our authority, how can we do this? This is a legislative function. And, in fact, though, this court authorized the payment of funds either expressly or implicitly, but it's authorized circuit courts to do it with county boards. It's happened again and again. We started with Carpenter versus Dane County in 1859.
Right. So if we have the authority to tell the counties how to spend their money, then why aren't you asking us to tell the legislature how to spend theirs?
Well, because we're in a crisis situation. And because there's many counties in the state that are literally in meltdown.
The $40 is a crisis. That's even bigger crisis than the $70, right? So if we have the authority to tell the counties to spend $100 an hour instead of $70, why don't we also have the authority to tell the legislature to pay $100 an hour instead of $40 for the SPD?
I think you do. I think you have the authority to tell them that if you're exercising in the context of your shared authority. You've already found in Friedrich and in other cases, but that's the main one, that you're the ultimate decider here. You're the ultimate decision maker on what constitutes the proper appointment of counsel rates. And in your role to administer justice and for the proper and efficient exercise of conduct of the courts in this state, you're the final arbiter here. So, but this court, when you order that you have to build a jury room for us, you're ordering them to spend money. When you order that you can't tell us what to do with our employees, we're going to decide how to do that. And
so the janitor case was not a financial question, though. That was just appointment and dismissal, right? So the superintendent of state property dismissed our janitor and appointed someone else. So it didn't have anything to do with the budget.
That's true. But the Barlin case did, which was a very similar scenario of court employees. And that involved the unions making a decision about who is going to be this particular judge's judicial assistant. And this court made the sound decision to say, no, I'm sorry, we're going to make our own decisions about how we operate our courts. And because that's in our purview. And so, that's a financial decision. I mean, it's couched as a labor dispute, but in essence, it's a financial decision. The only reason that they were changing that assistant in that case is because it costs less money.
Do we have the authority to create a new position? Do we have position creation authority?
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
So one of the, if we want new employees within the judicial system, generally we have to go to the legislature and ask for position authority. Do we have to do that, or can we just tell them?
Again, it's you can't just create things nilly-willy, you know. I mean, yes, you can demand to have a jury room, but you can't, again, I mean, every circuit court isn't going to be this building, right? So you can't just get everything you want, but you can demand to have the core things you need to run the court system. And one of the tools is attorneys, one of the major tools. And in fact, half of the public defense system in this state is assigned counsel. It's 40%, but about half.
Just to clarify, the janitor case, in that case, the court said that if the state superintendent of public property eliminated the janitor from the payroll, it will devolve upon the next legislature to make the requisite appropriation. So money was involved in that
That's
case.
Exactly right. That's exactly correct. Yes. Thank you. And so everything that this court does has a fiscal impact. But one of the most important things that you do is to make sure that the courts are running properly and efficiently all over the state, not just in a couple of counties. We have 72 counties. And that's not happening right now. And one of the, you might think that this petition is like the mission in my life. It's not. The mission in my life is to get people to start trying cases more. And the people that aren't trying cases are the people on the assigned counsel division because they're overwhelmed and they're trying to make a living and they can't do it. They can't try cases. When I was coming up in the 90s, after I got bitten by the criminal defense bug, I tried 20 cases a year doing all appointment cases. And I'd be doing them today if I could afford it. I'll be back in this court Monday when my clerk is getting sworn in. She's a Marquette law grad. And I'm going to put her on the list. And essentially, I'm subsidizing the state's obligation to provide a defense, but she's a true believer. That's why I'm willing to do it. But we're never going to get, it used to be, trials were the norm in this state. When I was a kid, there was a group of lawyers, at least in the Milwaukee area, that just tried cases all the time. 25-30% of the cases went to trial. You know how many go to trial now? 3%. That's the statistic I want to change. And we're not going to get there if we keep bleeding dry the public defense system. So, that's all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
you for all of the work that you and all of your co-petitioners did. This was a lot to put together. And I thank also all of the people that wrote to us. Many of them were not here, but some people sent us charts and facts and figures, and all of them were very helpful. Before we conclude, I have one matter, and I would like to publicly recognize at our last public hearing of the court for the term the contributions of Justice Michael Gableman. He will be leaving us for greener pastures and decided not to seek re-election, but I would be remiss if I didn't thank him publicly and allow you to thank him as well. He has been an outstanding member of the court, contributed in so many ways that I'm sure the public cannot even imagine. But we will miss him dearly. Justice
thank you,
Gableman.
Chief Justice. Thank you very, very much. Very, very good.
And with that, while you are up, we are adjourned.